Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Last month, a scorching heat wave baked the U.S. Pacific Northwest and British Columbia. It was 108 degrees in Seattle and 116 in Portland. Lytton, British Columbia broke the Canadian national temperature record 3 days in a row, hitting 121 degrees before the village burned down in a wildfire. The CBC reports that the village never had a chance. The fire encroached just too fast. The record-shattering high temperatures caused roads to buckle, melted power lines, hundreds died, and scientists estimate that more than 1 billion sea creatures, including clams, mussels, barnacles, and snails, cooked to death on the coast of Vancouver. A study published today in Nature Climate Change is warning that much of the United States, Europe, and Asia must prepare for more record heat events in the coming decades that will shatter previous record temperatures by large margins. We have seen recent deadly extreme weather events in many parts of the world, most notably the deadly floods in Germany and China. Floods in western Germany killed at least 170 people. The footage of these floods was just shocking. In central China, authorities say heavy rains and floods have displaced more than 1 million people and at least 63 people were killed. So how is the climate crisis impacting weather events, and are we at a tipping point? Today we're joined by two guests. Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael Mann is the author of many books. His latest is The New Climate War: The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Hi, Professor Mann. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you. Always good to be with you, Rose.
Always great to have you. Noah Diffenbaugh is the Kara J. Foundation Professor and Kimmelman Family Senior Fellow at Stanford University. Noah Diffenbaugh studies the climate system, including the processes by which climate change could impact agriculture, water resources, and human health. Noah Diffenbaugh has also served as a lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and has provided testimony and scientific expertise to federal, state, and local officials. Hi, Professor Diffenbaugh. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have both of you. Thank you so much. Professor Mann, I want to start off with you. It is hard to keep up with all of this. As we were putting the show together, we learned about two new studies, the one I mentioned about, you know, basically warning almost the entire world to prepare for more record heat events. And then there's another study that we found in The Guardian. The headline is "Flash floods will be more common as climate crisis worsens," according to scientists. Michael Mann, how alarming. I mean, this is all very alarming. Can you just give us your overall thoughts on all of this?
Sure. As I like to say, the truth is bad enough. We don't need to stretch it. We don't need to exaggerate it to emphasize the urgency now of the climate crisis. And this latest study, in fact, both of these studies that you cite, those findings aren't all that new to researchers in the field, in the sense that we know, for example, that when, you know, you warm the planet rapidly, you're going to see more and more of these record-shattering extremes. And this latest study tries to quantify that, the fact that we're likely to see worse floods, worse heat waves, worse wildfires. We were saying that decades ago. The climate science community was really saying that decades ago. Here's the thing. The signal is now emerging from the noise. In the past, we had to sort of squint to see the impact of climate change in our daily weather. But the signal now has grown large enough that we can see the impacts of climate change playing out in real time on our television screens, in our newspaper headlines. And so it's not that this is happening faster than we expected. The problem is that it's happening as we expected. And with one caveat here, the models that were used in this latest study and many of the studies that we use to sort of project future increases in extreme weather events are actually pretty conservative in that there are some processes that we've identified that are important in these real world extremes, like this Pacific Northwest heat dome. And it has to do with subtle ways that climate change impacts the behavior of the jet stream, and you get these weather systems that get locked in place. There's some indication that this is playing an important role, and it's a role that isn't quite captured in these climate models. So the climate models, if anything, are actually somewhat conservative in attributing the impacts of climate change on extreme weather events. And that's sort of what we're seeing now. We're seeing it play out in real time.
So given that these models are pretty conservative, what message does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that uncertainty is not our friend. Uncertainty is not, as the critics would like to claim, cause for inaction. It's actually cause for even more urgent action because of the very real possibility that the impacts will be greater, will be worse than we predicted. The warming is pretty much proceeding as we predicted it to, but some of these important impacts, like these increases in weather extremes, the melting of ice, the collapse of the ice sheets and rise in sea level, some of these very important impacts are happening sooner and with a greater magnitude than we predicted.
Professor Diffenbaugh, what would you add?
Well, I think that, you know, what's, really accentuating, that acceleration of impacts is, the ways in which having these events that fall outside of our historical experience really catch us off guard. As Professor Mann was saying earlier, with studies going back years and decades, projecting exactly these kinds of changes, we have studies in recent years, definitively concluding that the global warming that's already happened has increased the probability of unprecedented extreme events, the impacts of those kinds of events that are so far outside what we've designed around in terms of our infrastructure, in terms of our risk management system, in terms of our disaster preparation and response, there is a very nonlinear, the impacts are nonlinear. And I say that both in a technical mathematical sense, in that the papers that analyze those, identify a nonlinear relationship. But it's also just, if we think colloquially, right, having a flood that doesn't get into the subway is a very different impact than having a flood that does. And so crossing those thresholds, for us as humans, it's very hard to prepare for conditions that are more extreme than the conditions we've experienced in the past, or the conditions that our whole systems are designed around. And that's what we're experiencing now. And it's, it's not just a risk for the future. It's a result of the climate change that's already happened.
One thing I've been noticing, especially on the cable shows, is that the hosts are now talking about the climate crisis on a fairly regular basis, finally, and they are asking an important question. Professor Mann, you've been asked this many times. I just saw your hit on CNN recently. How is the climate crisis fueling these extreme weather events?
Yeah, it's simple. This is climate change. This is what climate change looks like. We simply would not be seeing these extreme events, these record-shattering events, in the absence of our warming of the planet from burning fossil fuels and increasing levels of carbon pollution into the atmosphere. That heat dome in one recent study was estimated to be a one in I don't know how many tens of thousands of years event. I think the authors called it essentially impossible in the absence of climate change. Here's the thing that concerns me. When those authors took account of the impact of climate change, they said it's still a 1,000-year event. I mean, even when they took into account the effect of climate change on these extreme weather events, they found that it shouldn't happen more often than once in 1,000 years. And to me, that sort of you know, it emphasizes the fact that the models aren't necessarily capturing all of the processes that are important here, that this event was not that unlikely when you take into account, as Noah aptly put it, some of these non-linearities. And I'll give just one example with the heat dome. We think that this jet stream behavior that I talked about, where the high pressure systems get locked into place, and it's not very well captured in current models, that played a role. But there was another non-linearity, which is that when you heat up the ground, you dry it out. When you dry out the ground, there isn't as much moisture, and the evaporation of moisture is part of how the ground cools off. And so the conditions become even hotter. This exacerbates the heat, and these soil moisture responses are at best imperfectly taken into account in the climate model simulations of these events.
Professor Diffenbaugh, we'll talk about the heat dome in a minute, but what would you add to that question? How is the climate crisis fueling extreme weather?
There are a couple of pathways. One is just adding heat to the climate system. And, so when the conditions that come together that create heat waves in the normal climate, when those conditions come together, they're amplified. They're amplified by processes like like the soil moisture feedbacks, like the the duration of these the kinds of atmospheric configurations that produce heat waves, the intensity, right? So there are these effects that are basically from adding heat to the climate system, that hot events are hotter, wet events are wetter, right? Because there's more water in the atmosphere when the storm conditions come together. Storm surge flooding from landfalling storms is more extensive because that storm surge is happening on a higher floor of sea level rise. So these are pathways. Snow melt, which we know, here in California in the West, we're so dependent on for our water supply. Precipitation, larger fraction falling as rain, the snow that does fall melting earlier in the year, right? These are all what scientists call, thermodynamic, just the effects of having more heat in the climate system. I think a second way, which is, more complicated and more difficult to understand, more noisy, is the bringing together of novel conditions, right? And so all of these extreme events result from a confluence of multiple different conditions. That's just by definition, the extremes are the tail events, and they always result from multiple different conditions coming together. And there are aspects of the climate system where we're seeing that the ingredients, we're getting novel combinations of ingredients coming together. And what that means is that, we're starting to get caught off guard with events that are not just more intense than the kinds of events we've had in the past, but are novel because the combinations of causes are novel.
Today we are talking about the climate crisis, all of these events that we've been experiencing and seeing in other parts of the world, floods, droughts, fires. We're joined today by Michael Mann, distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and author of many books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Noah Diffenbaugh is the Kara J. Foundation professor and Kimmelman Family Senior Fellow at Stanford University. If you have any questions for our guests about what we are experiencing with the climate crisis, where we are today and where we're going, we're definitely going to ask them about how to tackle this at a time when it's so hard to get politicians to move on this issue. In fact, the American Prospect just reported that the DCCC's top bundler is an oil lobbyist. And then a couple weeks ago, we spoke with Aaron Cantu of Climate in Maine about why climate bills keep dying in the California Senate, We'll definitely talk about that a little later in the show. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's talk a little bit more about the heat dome and what we can expect. So many studies are out now about how heat affects health. And according to the latest numbers, oh gosh, it looks like 200 people died in the United States as a result of that heat wave. Businesses shut down because it was just too much for employees. So Michael Mann, can you tell us more about how this heat dome works? What is this heat dome, especially given that this new study came out and said that we need to start preparing for this on a regular basis?
Yeah, so this heat dome, it's just a very stagnant area, a very stagnant system of high pressure. High pressure means clear skies, heating from the sun. It's associated with very dry conditions. It's associated with descending motion in the atmosphere. It's the flip side of a low pressure. A low pressure is an area where you have rising motion, where you have clouds, where you have rainfall. And often these systems come sort of in combinations because they relate to the waviness of the jet stream. So if you have a high pressure in one area, like the heat dome out west, that's a ridge. That's sort of the upsurge of the wave. On the other side, say back in the eastern U.S., you've got a low pressure center, a trough. And so while California has been getting, in Oregon and Washington, this heat, this drought, and you put heat and drought together, you get those wildfires. Back east, we've had a very wet season. We've had a very wet summer. And so this is one of the ways where we're seeing increased extreme weather events. When those high and low pressure centers remain stagnant in the same place for days or even weeks on end, then the same location is getting baked by the sun day after day, or is getting drenched in pouring rain day after day. And that's where you see really the most extreme and dangerous weather impacts. Our research suggests that those sorts of stagnant systems are being favored by this subtle way that climate change changes the behavior of the jet stream. It slows it down. It remains those systems to grow in magnitude and get locked in place. And that Pacific Northwest heat dome was one of those systems where we know that this particular process called resonance played a role. It certainly played a role in initiating that. So the climate models, as I've said, don't entirely reproduce that behavior. And so that's part of why the models don't expect to see events like this as often as they're happening. But, you know, make no mistake, that's one of the great killers when it comes to climate change impacts. Flooding is a killer, but so is extreme heat. And there are larger and larger portions of the planet that will essentially become too hot, simply too hot for human beings if we continue on the course that we're on. Under sort of business as usual, an article I was a co-author on earlier this year shows that parts of the Pacific Northwest, for example, are likely to see more than a tripling of heat stress as the heat and population growth and demographic factors all come together in, if you'll forgive the expression, a perfect storm of consequences when it comes to heat and mortality. And we're seeing that around the world.
Mm. And Noah, what would you add?
Well, I think, certainly this, the soil moisture feedbacks and the feedbacks to the atmospheric circulation, the Professor Mann was describing, these have been identified for a long time. Initially in understanding the processes that create heat waves in the first place, independent of climate change. So, going back decades now, there's been research on heat waves like occurred during the Dust Bowl era back in the early part of the 20th century. The European heat wave in 2003 the lead author of the paper that came out today that you mentioned about the record shattering events, Eric Fisher. Eric Fisher actually did work on the 2003 heat wave many years ago, showing that the soil moisture deficits actually promoted that high pressure condition that amplified and sustained the heat wave. A similar research has been shown for the 2010 Russia heat wave. So this is a fundamental physical property of the climate system. And it's something that we've known for many years would, you know, be amplified in these mid-latitude regions in response to global warming. My first study on those processes was back in 2005, and I certainly was not the first. I was adding, you know, a little tiny brick in a wall of studies that had been going for many years. So I think that, you know, the point of me going through this literature that, you know, probably at the time seemed esoteric to scientists, is that what we're seeing play out in these events right now, this summer, and in previous years, it really is exactly what has been predicted, and it's been predicted for a long time. And I'm just constantly humbled, personally, as a researcher, you know, going back and finding the papers, you know, from many decades ago, before I, you know, in some cases when I was in middle school, or, you know, even before I was born. You know, Suki Manabe had papers on this soil moisture heat wave feedback, back in the earliest days of climate modeling. So I think we should feel confident that, our understanding of the climate system and how extreme events respond to climate change is really, you know, is really well established and is just being tragically confirmed by these accelerating extremes around the world.
And Michael Mann, this brings up so many issues around access. Who has access to a hotel, for example, in Oregon or in Seattle? I saw people on social media saying that they were actually going to hotels where they had access to air conditioning. A Washington Post analysis of early mortality data in the county where Portland is located, 61% of the deaths were in zip codes with higher than average poverty rates. So, I mean, there are so many angles to all of this. Vivek Chandas with the Portland State University told a House subcommittee that those who died lacked access to financial capital, social networks, and had aging or injured bodies. So we know that this is going to hit those who are in low-income communities the hardest.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to very quickly follow up on a point that Noah made, which is important. You know, qualitatively, the sorts of events that we're seeing now are what we predicted decades ago. Now, there are some sort of specifics here where, you know, again, the models might not be capturing all of the processes that are relevant. And so we do need to remain humble. For example, the 2003 European heat wave was a great example of one of these so-called resonance events, that part of what it made it so extreme was the way that the jet stream sort of got locked in place and the high pressure dome, in that case over Europe, grew in magnitude. So there are these processes that are important in these real world events that we know aren't very well captured yet by the climate models. And so we have to keep that in mind. The models provide guidance, but uncertainty is not our friend here. And we unfortunately have to be prepared for the possibility of surprises. And most of those surprises are going to be unpleasant ones. It emphasizes the urgency of action, which sort of leads us to this next point. You know, those who are suffering the worst consequences of climate change literally had the least role in creating the problem in the first place. That is true of future generations who will see the worst impacts of climate change based on the carbon emissions, you know, from decades that preceded them. So they will see the worst consequences of the decisions that we are making right now. Moreover, those with the least wealth, the least access to basic, air conditioning, basic, infrastructure, are the ones who die in the greatest numbers. And by the way, the pollution, coal-fired power plants, the fossil fuel pollution is often generated in regions of low income, where people are also impacted by the air quality problems associated with fossil fuel generation. So that's why we've seen such an emphasis on social justice and what we call climate justice. This is a matter of justice. Acting on climate change is a matter of acting to address social injustice, because those with the least resources, either regionally or urban versus rural environments, those with the least resources had the least role in creating the problem in the first place. And that's a real ethical quandary. And it requires that we provide special assistance to those frontline communities who are bearing the brunt. And I was pleased to see that that's a major part of Joe Biden's infrastructure plan. The question is, will that survive the current politics of the congressional infrastructure bill? It's very important we keep pressure on our politicians to make sure that those and other important climate measures stay in this prospective bill.
We're going to take a quick break. Michael Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Noah Diffenbaugh is Professor and Kimmelman Family Senior Fellow at Stanford University. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about how the climate crisis is fueling extreme weather. We're joined by Noah Diffenbaugh, Professor and Kimmelman Family Senior Fellow at Stanford University, and Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for your usual wonderful program. It's great to listen to Dr. Mann. I had a comment and a question. My comment is, it seems like a structural problem. If I'm working over in Fremont and I have to drive over to Stanford every day, I may not be able to afford an electric car unless I get some help. And so it seems to me that it's expecting a lot for people to suddenly change the behavior that gives them an income. But my question is something different. I'm wondering about the smoke. It looks on the fire and smoke map that the smoke goes all the way to my hometown in Buffalo and to New York City. And it seems to loop around. Is that in the upper atmosphere, or is that is this just wind patterns, or...
Yeah, this is a fascinating one. And the New York Times has this incredible map just looking at the smoke and how it's moving. Michael Mann, do you want to take that one first?
Sure thing. I was down in Australia a year and a half ago during what they called the Black Summer. It was every bit as catastrophic as what we're witnessing here, but it was down under. And satellite images showed that the wildfire smoke being generated in Australia was making it all the way, was circumnavigating the globe multiple times. Mm-hmm. And so when you produce that amount of smoke and it gets up, these are hot, very hot, very intense fires. And so the lifting takes that smoke, takes those particulates and brings them all the way into the upper part of what we call the troposphere, 10 miles, up in the atmosphere, 8 to 10 miles up in the atmosphere, where it gets entrained into the jet stream. And the jet stream, those strong winds aloft, carry this stuff around the globe multiple times. So that's what we're seeing here as well. We're seeing that with these wildfires that are so large, so intense, so hot burning, that smoke is making it up into the upper troposphere. It's getting entrained into the jet stream, and it's literally bringing it across. So here in central Pennsylvania, when I arrived back from travel a couple days ago and I smelled smoke, I initially wondered if there was a wildfire somewhere here, and then realized, no, I was smelling wildfire smoke from the western U.S.
Wow. It's also important to note, we've done many shows about this, but health experts say the cloth masks that we've been wearing, do nothing to prevent smoke particles from getting inside your lungs. It's really important to get your hands on an N95 mask to deal with this smoke, and we'll definitely do shows about that. Noah Diffenbaugh, do you have anything to add on wildfire smoke? Also, according to studies, we were supposed to start smelling it last night in the Bay Area.
Well, I think, you know, we were talking earlier about kind of nonlinear accelerating impacts. And I think, you know, certainly here in the West, the wildfire smoke is one of them. You know, these very large fires and multiple very large fires burning in the region simultaneously, you know, in recent years, you know, it has really impacted millions of people. And, you know, research from my colleagues here at Stanford, Kari Nato and her research group, you know, has tracked the smoke over very long distances and, monitored the physiological impacts on individual people. The health effects are very geographically broad. At both at the individual level and at the population level. And there are, you know, very, you know, as with so many climate impacts, very, you know, there's a lot of inequality in those impacts, the big, distributional impacts, that are very unequal. This is one of the consequences of the very rapid increase in area burned, we've had in the West, the very rapid increase in these very, very large fires, is that we're getting this very pervasive smoke that persists for long periods and impacts many, many, many more people than those who are directly affected by the fires.
And Noah, before we get to the next caller, you have been studying California's climate for years. What are your thoughts about where we're headed in California? Because there have been a lot of segments on how, for example, Lake Mead is tipping toward a crisis. So many lakes are just so far below capacity. And then, of course, it's only, you know, at the end, almost the end of July. And the fire season is especially up near Tahoe, up at the border, California, Oregon. The fires are bad up there. So what are your thoughts on what we should expect in California?
We were talking in the last segment, kind of about the history of scientific research on climate change and how far back it goes. And I mentioned that I'm constantly humbled by, the studies that predate my, my awareness. In terms of California climate, there was this Discover Magazine, cover article back in 1988 when I was in middle school. Andrew Revkin, had a cover article on climate change. And one of the features in that article was about California's climate and the changing California climate, and featured Peter Glick's work from the 80s. And Peter Glick's projections of the snow hydrology in response to climate change were exactly what's unfolding, right? So warming climate, which means that the more rainfall at the expense of snowfall during the wet season, more runoff, more need, a more melting of snowpack earlier in the year, more need to empty reservoirs during the wet season, creating increased flood risk during the winter, and lack of snow melt, lack of reservoir capacity during the warm season, increased water deficits, greater water stress, increased drought. It's exactly what's playing out. It's a real challenge to adapt to it. We've got a very sophisticated water management system that was designed and built, depending on which aspect of it you're looking at, 50 to 100 years ago. We got a legal rights system that goes back even further. And, you know, California has been very proactive. You know, we have the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We have, you know, very proactive state government, very proactive local governments and non-governmental actors that are working hard to try to catch up. But the reality is that we're not caught up with the climate change that's already happened, and it's accelerating. The impacts are accelerating. And, you know, it's a big challenge to transform. And I think what I've just described is, you know, a microcosm of what's playing out, in many parts of the world.
Well, thank you for the call, Eileen. Let's hear next from Jerry in Cupertino. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. A couple of things. I believe that, Professor Mann has talked about the jet stream, causing, you know, blips in the jet stream causing the heat dome over the western U.S. I was wondering, actually three questions, but is there a possibility the jet stream can be permanently changed by the changes in the climate? That is, as things get hotter, will it change its aspect? Similarly, although your guests are not oceanographers, there is something called the Global Ocean Conveyor, which is also based on temperature differences. I haven't heard anything about that recently. And thirdly, what is going on? The poles have seen some record temperatures. If in fact the poles get warmer, is that going to affect the way that you know, the jet stream flows? How is that going to affect the climate globally?
All right, thank you for that. Michael Mann, do you want to take those?
Sure. So the caller, and thanks for the question. It's a great question, and the caller alluded to the you know, the role that Arctic warming plays here. So the Arctic is warming faster than much of the rest of the planet. We call this Arctic amplification. It has to do with the melting of ice and other factors that come into play with climate change. Now, the jet stream owes its existence to the difference in temperature between the warm subtropics and the cold polar region. That's actually responsible for the jet stream. These strong winds aloft in mid-latitudes that blow from west to east are driven by this contrast between warm subtropics, cold polar region. So if you warm the pole faster than the rest of the planet, you decrease that contrast and you slow down the jet stream. That's a robust projection, a robust prediction that was made decades ago based, as Noah mentioned, on climate modeling decades ago, captured that basic sort of attribute of climate change. And so that does mean that the jet stream tends to slow down. You're more likely to get those wobbly jet streams that don't travel very far, have big wiggles in them. And the bigger the wiggles, the bigger the highs and lows, the bigger the high and low pressure centers. And they're not moving along as fast. And they get locked in place. And you get those very persistent heat domes out west this summer, or the very persistent low pressure raininess back east here. And so it is all connected. There is also the conveyor belt ocean circulation that the caller asked about. And I've done some research on that over the years. Basically, that is driven by contrasts in temperature, which influence ocean density. The density of water depends on temperature, but also contrasts in salinity. The saltier the water, the heavier it is. And if it's cold and salty, it wants to sink. And that helps sort of drive this overall conveyor belt of warm subtropical water moving north towards Greenland, towards Iceland, into the North Atlantic, and then sinking and driving this conveyor that delivers heat into the high latitudes of the North Atlantic. Now, salinity depends on how fresh the water is. The fresher it is, the lower the salinity. And global warming is leading to a melting of ice, and in particular in Greenland, the ice is melting earlier than we expected it to. That means the fresh water off Greenland is making its way into the North Atlantic earlier than we expected it to. It's making the waters there lighter, which inhibits the sinking motion that drives the conveyor, and it's slowing the conveyor down. That is one impact, among others, that is playing out earlier than we expected. And it, we believe it's because some of these processes like ice sheet collapse are proceeding faster than expected. Now, it won't lead to anything like the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which envisions a whole new ice age because of the slowdown of the ocean conveyor. That's very unlikely to happen. What we will see is cooling in some regions in the North Atlantic, a potential rising of sea level across along the east coast of the U.S., even greater sea level rise, and that has to do with the complicated physical oceanography of how the current relates to sea level. So you get greater sea level rise, you probably get less ocean productivity, and those very important natural fisheries of the North Atlantic that feed so many millions of people around the world could be impacted. So another reminder, uncertainty isn't our friend. Some of these impacts are playing out earlier and with potentially very damaging consequences.
Mm. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for the questions, Jerry. Let's hear next from Bill in Boulder Creek. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I saw a video on YouTube not too long ago. It was with a featured a Jew engineer from Harvard University. He said that these people were aware of this problem and they were using the HAARP system to change the weather. I was wondering if you had any information on that or you cared to comment.
Michael Mann, any comment?
I was hoping you were going to give that one to Noah. Geoengineering, you know, is HAARP is something else. It's not geoengineering. And if, you know, it actually has its origins in some conspiracy theories about cloud seeding and such. But so let me separate out HAARP in some of these very early atmospheric experiments from the very real geoengineering proposals that we are seeing come out of places like Harvard, where some individuals are saying, look, we're not going to get our act together soon enough to decrease our carbon emissions fast enough to avoid catastrophic warming. So why don't we shoot particles into the stratosphere to block out some of the incoming sunlight to try to cool the planet back off? I won't go into the details other than to say that the principle of unintended consequences reigns supreme with many of these so-called geoengineering approaches. And I think they could very well leave us even worse off. And by the way, they are used by some to take the pressure off of the demand for polluters to decrease carbon emissions now. Basically, look, we have this techno fix that we can, you know, implement a decade from now or two decades from now. So don't worry. We can continue to burn fossil fuels now. We'll just fix the problem later. That's obviously a prescription for a disaster. So I'm not fond of many of these geoengineering approaches, and I'm not fond of the way that they are being used in some circumstances to take pressure off of the necessary, safe way of solving this problem, which is stopping burning fossil fuels now.
Well, we're almost out of time, so let's take a few more callers in a row, and then we'll get comments from our guests, Michael Mann and Noah Diffenbaugh. Let's go to Scott in Santa Cruz. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. For the last 20 years or so, our government, our military, has been spraying aerosol particles, toxic heavy metals, into the upper atmosphere. For the last 20 years, everyone can see it. There are times where it's every day. And those are all the lines that go on for tens and tens of miles across our sky.
And where are you getting this information from, Scott?
I'm seeing with my own eyes.
All right, your own eyes.
Yeah,
all right. Well, thank you for the call. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Fran in San Francisco. Hi, Fran. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. My question has to do with what is currently happening. I want your opinions on why people rebuild in fire zones where the fires are repeated and constant. Do you think people should be spending money to rebuild and secondly, I think they should use money to make more good shelters that are cool for now, where the areas are definitely being affected, So, you know, spend money on that for the people now so they don't get sick and die. What do you think?
This is such an important one. Thank you, Fran. We'll take one more caller and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Two quick points. One, I was just reading a couple of articles about the predictions that the International Energy Agency was making about substantial increases by 2023 and beyond. And the other is that right now, if my information is correct, we're emitting between 30 and 40 billion metric tons globally of emissions. Even if we cut that in half by 2030, I'm wondering if at 15 billion metric tons of emissions, if that were able to get cut down to, what impact would that still have on the atmosphere?
All right. Thank you for that. Noah, why don't you take the question? This comes up on a regular basis. Why are people rebuilding in fire zones in California?
Yeah, I think the broader question is about how do we adapt to this, to the changing climate? How do we adapt to a climate that you know, is already different and is already impacting us and will continue to intensify, including if emissions are cut in half in the next decade? We'll continue to get more global warming, more extreme events. And you know, there are a lot of challenges with that. And you know, on the question of rebuilding in places that have experienced disasters, I'll refer the caller and all the listeners to the op-ed by Catherine Mock and Ann Siders in the New York Times last weekend on managed retreat. And they have a number of different peer-reviewed papers on managed retreat as well. So the whole question of how do we, you know, when we're experiencing chronic stresses from the climate system in place, in particular places, how do we respond? And we can you know, rebuild and try to increase resilience. And as Professors Mock and Siders argue, there's also a role for deliberate migration. There are a lot of barriers to that. And I think if we imagine the person, you know, in who the caller described, who's, you know, had their home destroyed, you know, on land that, you know, in our California legal system, they are the owners of, to say, why are you rebuilding on the land where your home was, where you own the land, as opposed to moving, I think is, you know, is raises a lot of questions, that aren't easy to solve. And then in terms of the heat shelters, again, this is also part of, you know, the questions of how do we adapt? And, you know, the good news is that we, you know, humans do actually live in a really, really broad range of conditions. We survive and thrive as a species in a very, very broad range of conditions, everywhere from the Sahara Desert to Antarctica and everywhere in between. So we do have a lot of lessons of how we can adapt, where we're seeing, you know, these really, really catastrophic events with lots of loss of life, lots of displacement, lots of destruction. You know, these are areas where the conditions are exceeding what, you know, the range that we've built around and we've designed around. So heat, these areas that don't have air conditioning, that are experiencing, you know, Portland experiencing temperatures that are, you know, essentially as hot as any city in the U.S. has ever experienced. Likewise, all the way up to British Columbia with these flood levels, right? It's really crossing those thresholds. And so I think, you know, one of the real potential win-wins is taking the lessons from other parts of the world where different conditions are adapted, how to accelerate our adoption of those adaptation measures even if we haven't already experienced the climate change or the most extreme events, because those are on the horizon.
Professor Mann, we are almost out of time. What about Greg's second question? Even if we take drastic measures and let's say cut what we're doing in half, now there's 15 billion metric tons of emissions. What kind of impact will it have? We have just about a minute left.
Sure. So I'll try to tie these two things together because, of course, we have to be prepared to adapt to the changes that are now inevitable. We're already dealing with climate-related crises. We need to provide resources. We need to achieve resilience in dealing with the climate change that's already here. But we have to prevent all of the additional climate change that we can, because if we continue with business as usual, we will exceed our adaptive capacity as a species. That means decarbonizing our economy, bringing carbon emissions down by a factor of two within the next decade, and bringing them down to zero by mid-century. That's what we need to do to avert the worst impacts of climate change. That requires action now, policy action now. It requires a congressional bill, infrastructure bill, that does put climate change and addressing the climate crisis at the very center of the legislation.
Professor Mann, now that we have one more minute, actually, I just looked at the clock. I just want to ask you quickly, we did a piece about the Exxon lobbyist who thought he was doing a job interview, but he was actually being taped by Greenpeace UK, just talking about how they aggressively fought against some of the science on climate change. He also said that ExxonMobil meets with Democratic Senator Joe Manchin on a regular basis. The Oversight and Reform Committee just sent him a letter today asking him to testify, and they're asking him to respond by Friday. What are your thoughts about all of this? Just given that this is ExxonMobil basically saying that they talk with Joe Manchin on a regular basis.
Yeah, this is them just, you know, this is a peek behind the curtain. This is them saying what we already knew was true. Look, they've targeted a couple conservative Democrats in red states and fossil fuel states, coal states like West Virginia, Joe Manchin, who they think they can get on board for their agenda because they know that all they have to do is prevent 50 Democrats from supporting a major climate change-oriented infrastructure package. So that's what they're doing. They're trying to just work on a couple of these politicians to prevent any action from being taken. Because look, ExxonMobil in the early 1980s, as I described in the New Climate War, their own scientists said that the consequences of climate inaction would be catastrophic. Those were ExxonMobil's own words. But what did they do? They got rid of that division. They buried that report. And instead, they spent tens of millions of dollars in a massive disinformation campaign to discredit independent scientists who had come to the same conclusion as their own scientists. So we know they've been doing that for decades. Now we have to rein them in. There have to be consequences for bad actors like certain fossil fuel companies that have used their immense power and wealth to block action with respect to the greatest challenge we face as a civilization. It is deeply unethical, and there have to be consequences.
Michael Mann, professor at Penn State, and Noah Diffenbaugh, professor at Stanford, thank you both for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Thank you.